daughter of the king stag when the young stag is grown. Kevin leaned his head on his hands. He looked old and ill and weary.
That day is not yet, Ninian. Do not seek to push Gwydion so swiftly he will be destroyed, merely because he is your lover.
And he rose and limped out of the room without looking back, leaving Ninian sullen and angry. How did that wretched man know that? And she told herself, I am under no vows like the Christian nuns. If I choose to take a man to my bed, that is for me to say, even if that man should be my pupil and only a boy when he came here. In the first years he had twined himself around her heart, a lonely boy, lost and bereft, with none to love him or care for him, or wonder how he did. Morgause was the only mother he had known, and now he was parted from her too. How could Morgaine have found it in her heart to give up a fine son like this, clever and beautiful and wise, and never send to inquire how he did, or come to set eyes on him? Ninian had never borne a child, though she had thought, sometimes, that if she had come from Beltane with her womb filled, she would have liked to bear a daughter to the goddess. But it had never gone thus with her, and she hadn't rebelled against her lot. But in those first years she had let Gwydion find his way into her heart. And then he had gone from them, as men must do, grown too old for the teachings of the priestesses, to be taught among the druids and schooled in the arts of war. And he had returned one year at Beltane, and she thought it was by craft that he had come near to her in the fire rites, and she had gone apart with him. But they hadn't parted when that season was over, and whenever, after that, in his comings and goings, anything had brought him to Avalon, she had made it clear that she wanted him, and he hadn't said her no. I am closest to his heart, she thought. I know him best. What does Kevin know of him? And now the time has come when he shall return to Avalon, and shall have his trial as King Stag. And she turned her thoughts to that. Where would she find a maiden for him? There are so few women in the House of Maidens who are even halfway fit for this great office, she thought, and there was sudden pain and dread in her thoughts. Kevin was right. Avalon is drifting, dying. Few come here for the ancient teachings, and there are none to keep the rites. And one day there will be no one at all. And again she felt that almost painful prickling in her body which came to her, now and again, in lieu of the sight. Gwydion came home to Avalon a few days before Beltane. Ninian greeted him formally at the boat, and he bowed to her in reverence before the maidens and the assembled folk of the island. But when they were alone, he caught her in his arms and kissed her, laughing, until they were both breathless. His shoulders had broadened, and there was a red seam on his face. He had been fighting, she could tell. He no longer had the untroubled look of a priest and scholar. My lover and my child. Is this why the great goddess has no husband, after the Roman fashion, but only sons, as we are all her children? And I, who sit in her place, must feel my lover as my son too. For all those who love the goddess are her children.
And the lands are astir with it, he said, here in Avalon, and among the old people of the hills, that on Dragon Island the old people will be choosing their king again. It was for this that you summoned me there, was it not? Sometimes, she thought, he could be as infuriating as an arrogant child.
I don't know, Gwydion. The time may not be ripe, and the tides may not be ready. nor can I find anywhere within this house anyone to play for you the part of the Spring Maiden.
Yet it will be this spring, he said quietly, and this Beltane, for I have seen it.
Her mouth curved a little as she said, And have you then seen the priestess who will admit you to the rite when you have worn the antlers, supposing that the sight does not mislead you to your death? She thought, as he faced her, that he had but grown more beautiful, his face cold and set, dark with hidden passion.
I have, Ninian. Do you not know that it was you?
She said, suddenly chilled to the bone, I am no maiden. Why do you mock me, Gwydion?
Yet I have seen you, he said, and you know it as well as I. In her the maiden and the mother and the crone meet and blend. She will be old and young as it shall please her, virgin and beast and mother, and the face of death in the lightning, flowing and filling and returning again to her virginity.
Ninian bent her head and said, Gwydion, no, it cannot be.
I am her consort, he said implacably, and shall win it there. It is not the time for a virgin. The priests make much of that nonsense. I call upon her as the mother to give me my due and my life.
Ninian felt as if she were trying to stand against some relentless tide that would sweep her away. She said, hesitating, So it has always been, that in the running of the deer, though the mother sends him forth, he returns again to the maiden. Yet there was reason in what he said. Surely it was better to have a priestess for the rites who knew what she was doing, rather than some half-trained child new come to the temple, whose only qualification was that she wasn't yet old enough to feel the call to the Beltane fire. Gwydion spoke truth. The mother ever renews herself, mother and crone, and again the maiden, even as the moon who hides herself in the dark sky. She bent her head and said, Let it be so. You shall make the great marriage with the land and with me in her name. But when she was alone again, she was frightened. How had she come to agree to this? What, in the name of the goddess, was this power in Gwydion that he could make all men do his will? Is this, then, his heritage from Arthur and the blood of the Pendragon? And ice flooded her again.
What of the king's stag?
Morgaine was dreaming.
Beltane and the deer running on the hills, and the life of the forest running through her body, as if every part of the forest was a part of the life within her. He was down among the deer, the running stag, the naked man with the antlers tied on his brow, and the horns thrust down and down, his dark hair matted with blood. But he was on his feet, charging, a knife flashing in the sunlight through the trees. And the king stag came crashing down, and the sound of his bellowing filled the forest with cries of despair. And then she was in the dark cave, and the signs painted there were painted on her body. She was one with the cave. And all around her the Beltane fires flared, sparks crashing upward. There was the taste of fresh blood on her mouth, and now the cave mouth was shadowed with the antlers. It shouldn't be the full moon. She shouldn't see so clearly that her naked body was not the slender body of a virgin, but that her breasts were soft and full and pink, as they had been when her child was born, almost as if they were dripping with milk. And surely she had been tested, that she came virgin to this rite. What would they say to her, that she came not as the spring maiden to the king's stag? He knelt at her side, and she raised her arms, welcoming him to the rite and to her body. But his eyes were dark and haunted. His hands on her were tender, frustrating, toying with pleasure as he denied her the rite of power.
It wasn't Arthur.
No.
This was Lancelot, King Stag, who should pull down the old stag, consort of the Spring Maiden. But he looked down at her, his dark eyes tormented by that same pain that struck inward through her whole body, and he said, "I would you were not so like to my mother, Morgaine." Terrified, her heart pounding, Morgaine woke in her own room, Urien sleeping at her side and snoring. Still caught up in the frightening magic of the dream, she shook her head in confusion to ward the terror away.
No.
Beltane is past. She had kept the rites with Accolon, as she had known she would do. She wasn't lying in the cave awaiting the King's Stag. And why, she wondered, why should this dream of Lancelot visit her now? Why did she dream not of Accolon, when she had made him her priest and lord of Beltane and her lover? Why, after so many years, should the memory of refusal and sacrilege strike inward at her very soul? She tried to compose herself for sleep again, but sleep wouldn't come, and she lay awake, shaken, until the sun thrust the rays of early summer into her chamber. Chapter 11 Guinevere had come to hate the day of Pentecost, when each year Arthur sent out word that all his old companions should come to Camelot and renew their fellowship. With the growing of peace in the land and the scattering of the old companions, every year there were fewer to come, more who had ties to their own homes and families and estates. And Guinevere was glad, for these Pentecost reunions put her too much in mind of those days when Arthur hadn't been a Christian king, but bore the hated Pendragon banner. At Pentecost Court he belonged to his companions, and she had no part at all in his life. She stood behind him now as he sealed the 24 copies his scribes had made, for every one of his fellow kings and many of his old companions. "Why do you send out a special call for them to come this year? Surely all those who have no other business will come without your calling."
"But that is not enough this year," said Arthur, turning to smile at her.
He was going grey, she realized, though he was so fair-haired that none could see unless they were standing quite close.
"I wish to assure them of such games and mock battles as will make all men aware that Arthur's legion is still well able to fight."
"Do you think any will doubt this?" Guinevere asked.
"Perhaps not. But there is this man, Lucius, in Les Britain. Bors has sent me word, and as all my subject kings came to my aid when the Saxons and Northmen would have overrun this island, so I am pledged to come to theirs. Emperor, he calls himself, of Rome."
"And has he any right to be emperor?"
Guinevere asked. "Need you ask? Far less than I, certainly," Arthur said. "There has been no emperor of Rome for more than 100 years, my wife. Constantine was emperor, and wore the purple, and after him Magnus Maximus, who went abroad over the Channel to try and make himself emperor. But he came never back to Britain, and God alone knows what befell him or where he died. And after him, Ambrosius Aurelianus rallied our people against the Saxons. And after him, Uther. And I suppose that either of them could have called himself emperor, or I. But I am content to be High King of Britain. When I was a boy, I read something of the history of Rome, and it was nothing new that some upstart pretender should somehow get the loyalty of a legion or two and proclaim himself to the purple. But here in Britain, it takes more than an eagle standard to make an imperator. Else would Urien's be emperor in this land. I have sent for him to come. It seems long since I have seen my sister."
Guinevere didn't answer that, not directly. She shuddered. "I do not want to see this land touched by war again and torn apart by slaughter."
"Nor do I," said Arthur. "I think every king would rather have peace."
"I am not so certain. There are some of your men who never cease speaking of the old days when they fought early and late against the Saxons.
and now they begrudge Christian fellowship to those same Saxons, no matter what their bishop says.
I do not think it is the days of war they regret, Arthur said, smiling at his queen. I think it is the days when we were all young, and the closeness that was between us all. Do you never long for those years, my wife?
Guinevere felt herself colouring. Indeed, she remembered well those days when Lancelot had been her champion, and they had loved. This was no way for a Christian queen to think, and yet she couldn't stop herself.
Indeed I do, my husband.
And as you say, perhaps it is only longing for my own youth. I am not young, she said, sighing, and he took her hand and said,
You are as beautiful to me, my dearest, as the day when we were first bedded.
And she knew that it was true. But she forced herself to be calm, not to blush. I am not young, she thought. It isn't seemly that I should think of those days when I was young, and regret them, because in those days I was a sinner and an adulteress. Now I have repented and made peace with God, and even Arthur has done penance for his sin with Morgaine. She forced herself to practicality, as befitted the Queen of all Britain. I suppose we shall have more visitors than ever, then, at Pentecost. I must take counsel with Kai and Sir Lucan as to where we shall bestow them all, and how we shall feast them. Will Bors come from Les Britain?
He will come if he can, Arthur said. Although Lancelot sent me a message earlier in this week, asking leave to go and aid his brother Bors if he is besieged there. I sent him word to come here, for it might be that we will all go. Now that Pellinore is gone, Lancelot is king there as Elaine's husband, while their son is a little child. And Agravaine will come for Morgawse of Lothian, and Uriens, or perhaps one of his sons. Uriens is marvellously well preserved for his years, but he is not immortal. His elder son is something of a fool, but Accolon is one of my old companions, and Uriens has Morgaine to guide and counsel him.
That seems not right to me, Guinevere said, for the Holy Apostle said that women should submit themselves to their husbands. Yet Morgawse rules still in Lothian, and Morgaine would be more than helpmeet to her king in North Wales.
You must remember, my lady, said Arthur, that I come of the royal line of Avalon. I am king, not only as Uther Pendragon's son, but because I am son of Igraine, who was daughter to the old lady of the lake. Guinevere, from time out of mind the lady ruled the land, and the king was no more than consort in time of war. Even in the days of Rome the legions dealt with what they came to call client queens who ruled the tribes. And some of them were mighty warriors. Have you never heard of the Queen Boadicea? She who, when her daughters were raped by the men of the legions, and the queen herself flogged as a rebel against Rome, raised an army and nearly drove all the Romans from these shores?
Guinevere said bitterly, I hope they killed her.
Oh, they did, and outraged her body. Yet it was a sign that the Romans couldn't hope to conquer without accepting that in this country the lady rules. Every ruler of Britain, down to my father Uther, has borne the title the Romans coined for a war leader under a queen. Dux Bellorum, Duke of War. Uther, and I after him, bear the throne of Britain as Dux Bellorum to the Lady of Avalon, Guinevere. Forget not that.
Guinevere said impatiently, I thought you had done with that you had professed yourself a Christian king, and done penance for your servitude to the fairy folk of that evil island.
Arthur said with equal impatience,
My personal life and my religious faith are one thing, Guinevere, but the tribes stand by me because I bear this.
His hand struck against Excalibur, belted at his side inside its crimson scabbard.
I survived in war because of the magic of this blade.
"You survived in war because God spared you to Christianize this land," said Guinevere.
"Some day, perhaps. That time is not yet, lady. In Lothian, men are content to live under the rule of Morgawes, and Morgaine is queen in Cornwall and in North Wales. If the time were ripe for all these lands to fall to the rule of Christ, then would they clamour for a king and not for a queen. I rule this land as it is, Guinevere, not as the bishops would have it to be."
Guinevere would have argued further, but she saw the impatience in his eyes and held her peace.
"Perhaps in time even the Saxons and the tribes may come to the foot of the cross. A day will come, so Bishop Patricius has said, when Christ will be the only king among Christian men, and kings and queens his servants. God speed the day." And she made the sign of the cross.
Arthur laughed.
"Servant to Christ will I be willingly," he said, "but not to his priests. No doubt, though, Bishop Patricius will be among the guests, and you may feast him as fine as you will."
"And Urians will come from North Wales," Guinevere said, "and Morgaine too, no doubt. And from Pellinore's land, Lancelot?"
"He will come," said Arthur, "though I fear, if you wish to see your cousin Elaine again, you must journey thither to make her a visit. Lancelot sent word that she is in childbed again."
Guinevere flinched.
She knew that Lancelot spent little time at home with his wife, but Elaine had given Lancelot what she could not, sons and daughters.
"How old now is Elaine's son?" "He is to be my heir. He should be fostered at this court," Arthur said.
And Guinevere replied, "I offered as much when he was born. But Elaine said that even if he was to be king one day, he must be brought up to a simple and modest manhood. You too were fostered as a plain man's son, and it did you no harm."
"Well, perhaps she is right," said Arthur. "I would like once to see Morgaine's son. He would be grown to manhood now. It has been 17 years. I know he cannot succeed me. The priests wouldn't have it. But he is all the son I have ever fathered, and I would like once to set eyes on the lad and tell him... I know not what I would like to tell him, but I would like to see him once."
Guinevere struggled against the furious retort that sprang to her lips. Nothing could be gained by arguing this again.
She said only, "He is well where he is."
She spoke the truth, and after she said it, she knew it was the truth. She was glad Morgaine's son was being reared on that Isle of Sorceries, where no Christian king could go. Schooled there, it was more certain than ever that no sudden swing of fortune would set him on the throne after Arthur. More and more, the priests and people of this land distrusted the sorcery of Avalon. Reared at court, it might be that some unscrupulous person would begin to think of Morgaine's son as a successor more legitimate than Lancelot's.
Arthur sighed.
"Yet it is hard for a man to know he has a son and never set eyes on him," he said. "Perhaps one day..." But his shoulders went up and then down in resignation. "No doubt you are right, my dear. What of the Pentecost feast? I know you will make it, as always, a memorable day."
And so she had done, Guinevere thought,
on that morning, looking out over the expanse of tents and pavilions. The great war-gaming field had been cleared and lined with ropes and banners, and the flags and banners of 50 petty kings and more than 100 knights were moving briskly in the summer wind on the heights. It was like an army encamped here. She sought out the banner of Pellinore, the white dragon he had adopted after the killing of the dragon in the lake. Lancelot would be there. It had been more than a year since she had seen him, and then formally before all the court. It had been many years since she had been alone with him, even for a moment.
The day before he had married Elaine, he had come to seek her out alone and to say farewell. He had been Morgaine's victim, too. He hadn't betrayed her. They had both been victim of the cruel trick Morgaine had played on them.
When he told her about it, he had wept, and she cherished the memory of his tears as the highest compliment he had ever given her.
Who had seen Lancelot weep?
"I swear to you, Guinevere, she trapped me. Morgaine sent me the false message, and a kerchief with your scent. And I think she drugged me too, or put some spell upon me." He had looked into her eyes, weeping, and she had wept too. "And Morgaine told Elaine some lie too, saying I was sick with love of her. We were there together. I thought it was you at first. It was as if I were under some enchantment. And then, when I knew it was Elaine in my arms, still I couldn't stop myself. And then they were all there with torches. What could I do, Gwen? I had taken the virgin daughter of my host. Pellinore would have been within his rights to kill me then and there in her bed.
Lancelot cried out. And then, his voice breaking, he had ended.
Would to God that I had rushed on his sword instead.
She had asked him, "You do not care at all for Elaine, then?" She had known it was an inexcusable thing to say, but she couldn't live without that reassurance. But while Lancelot might uncover his own misery to her, he would not speak of Elaine. He had only said, stiffly, that none of this was Elaine's fault, and that he was bound in honour to try to make her as happy as he could. Well, it was done. Morgaine had had her will. So she would see Lancelot and welcome him as her husband's kinsman no more. The other madness was past and gone. But she would see him, and that was better than nothing. She tried to banish all this with thoughts of the feast. Two oxen were being roasted. Would it be enough? And there was a huge wild boar taken in hunting a few days ago, and two pigs from the farms nearby being baked in a pit yonder. Already it smelled so good that a group of hungry children were hanging around sniffing the good smell. And there were hundreds of loaves of barley bread, many of which would be given away to the country folk who came to crowd around the edges of the field and watch the doings of the nobles, the kings and the knights and companions. And there were apples baked in cream, and nuts by the bushel, and confectionery for the ladies, honey cakes, and rabbits, and small birds stewed in wine. If this feast wasn't a success, certainly it wouldn't be for the want of good and abundant food. Sometime after the noon hour they gathered, a long line of richly dressed nobles and ladies coming into the great hall and being ushered to their proper places. The companions, as always, were shown to their places at the great round mead hall table. But huge as it was, it would no longer place all the assembled company. Gawain, who was always closest to Arthur, presented his mother, Morgause. She was leaning on the arm of a young man Guinevere didn't for a moment recognize. Morgause was as slender as ever, her hair still thick and rich, braided with gems. She sank in a curtsy before Arthur, who motioned her to rise and embraced her.
"Welcome, aunt, to my court."
"I have heard that you ride only white horses," said Morgause, "and so I have brought you one from the Saxon country. I have a fosterling there who sent it as a gift."
Guinevere saw Arthur's jaw tighten, and she too could guess who the fosterling must be. But he only said,
"A kingly gift, truly, aunt."
"I will not have the horse led into the hall, as I am told is the custom in the Saxon countries," Morgause said gaily. "I do not think the Lady of Camelot would like having her high hall garnished for guests turned into a byre. And no doubt your stewards have enough to do, Guinevere."
She embraced the queen. The younger woman was enveloped in a warm wave,
and close by she could see that Morgause's face was painted, her bright eyes lined with kohl. But she was beautiful, no less.
Guinevere said, "I thank you for your forbearance, Lady Morgause. It wouldn't be the first time a fine horse or dog had been led before my lord and king here in his hall, and I know 'tis meant as courtesy, but I have no doubt your horse will be waiting outside quite content. I do not think the hospitality of Camelot means much even to the finest of horses. He would rather dine in his stall. Though Lancelot used to tell us a tale of some Roman who had his horse fed on wine in a golden trough, and gave him honours and laurel wreaths."
The handsome young man at Morgause's side laughed and said, "I remember. Lancelot told that story at my sister's wedding. It was the emperor, Gaius the God, who made his favourite horse one of his senators. And when he died, the next emperor said something like, 'At least the horse had given no evil counsel and done no murder.' But do not the same, my lord Arthur. We have no chairs fit to hold such a companion, should you see fit to name your stallion as one of them."
Arthur laughed heartily and took the young man by the hand, saying,
"I will not, Lamorack."
And with a start, Guinevere realized who the young man at Morgause's side must be. He was Pellinore's son. Yes, she had heard some rumour of this, that Morgause had taken the young man as her favourite, even before her whole court. How could the woman share her bed with a man young enough to be her son? Why, Lamorack was only 25 even now. She looked with fascinated horror and secret envy at Morgause. She looked so young. She is still so beautiful, despite all her paint. And she does what she will and cares not if all men criticise her. Her voice was chill as she said, "Will you come and sit beside me, kinswoman, and leave the men to their talk?"
Morgause pressed Guinevere's hand.
"Thank you, cousin. I come so seldom to court. I am happy to sit for once among ladies and gossip about who is married and who has taken a paramour, and all the new fashions in gowns and ribbons. I am kept so busy in Lothian with the ruling of the land that I have small time for women's matters, and it is a luxury and a pleasure for me."
She patted Lamorack's hand, and when she thought no one noticed, brushed his temple with a surreptitious kiss.
"I leave you to the companions, my dear."
Her ample fragrance, the warm scent of her ribbons, and the folds of her gown almost dizzied Guinevere, as the Queen of Lothian sat beside her on the bench. Guinevere said, "If you are kept so busy with affairs of state, cousin, why do you not find a wife for Agravaine, and let him rule in his father's place, and give over the ruling of Lothian? Surely the folk there cannot be happy without a king?"
Morgause's laugh was warm and merry.
"Why, then I should have to live unwedded, since in that country the queen's husband is king, and, my dear, that wouldn't suit me at all. And Lamorack is over young to rule as king, though he has other duties, and I find him most satisfactory."
Guinevere listened with fascinated distaste. How could a woman Morgause's age make a fool of herself with so young a man? Yet his eyes followed Morgause, as if she were the most beautiful and fascinating woman in the world. He hardly looked at Isotta of Cornwall, who was bending before the throne now at the side of her elderly husband, Duke Marcus of Cornwall. Isotta was so beautiful that a little murmur went all down the hall. Tall and slender, with hair the colour of a new-struck copper coin. But no doubt Marcus had thought more of the Irish gold she wore at her throat and at the clasp of her cloak, and the Irish pearls braided into her hair, than the treasure of her beauty. Isotta was, Guinevere thought, the most beautiful woman she had ever seen. Next to Isotta, Morgause looked raddled and overblown, but still Lamorack's eyes followed her.
"Aye, Isotta is very beautiful," Morgause said. but it is told in the court of Duke Marcus that she has more of an eye for his heir, young Drewston, than for old Marcus himself. And who can blame her? But she is modest and discreet, and if she has sense enough to give the old man a child, though heaven knows she might fare better at such craft with the young Drewston at that. Morgawes chuckled. She looks not like a woman over-happy in her marriage-bed. Still, I don't suppose Marcus wants much more of her than a son for Cornwall. Marcus wants only for that, I think, before he declares that Cornwall belongs to him who keeps it, not to Morgain, who has it from Gaulois. Where is my kinswoman Morgain? I am eager to embrace her.
She is there, with Uriens, said Guinevere, looking to where the King of North Wales waited to approach the throne.
Arthur would have done better to marry Morgain into Cornwall, Morgawes said. But I think he felt Marcus was too old for her. Though he might well have married her to yonder young Drewston. His mother was kindred to Ban of Less Britain, and he is a distant cousin to Lancelot. And handsome almost as Lancelot himself, is he not, Guinevere? She smiled merrily and added, Ah, but I had forgotten. You are so pious a lady, you look never on the beauty of any man save your own wedded husband. But then, it is easy for you to be virtuous, married to one so young and handsome and gallant as Arthur. Guinevere felt that Morgawes's chatter would drive her mad. Did the woman think of nothing else? Morgawes said, I suppose you must speak a word or two of courtesy to Isotta. She is new come to Britain. I have heard she speaks little of our tongue, only that of her Irish homeland. But I have heard, too, that in her own country she was a notable mistress of herbs and magic, so that when Drewston fought with the Irish knight, the Marhaus, she healed him when none thought he could live, and so he is her faithful knight and champion. Or at least he said that was the reason. Morgawes chattered on. Though she's so beautiful, I wouldn't wonder. Perhaps I should make her known to Morgain. She, too, is a great mistress of herb lore and spells of healing. They would have much to speak of, and I think Morgain knows a little of the Irish tongue. And Morgain, too, is married to a man old enough to be her father. I think that was ill done of Arthur. Guinevere said stiffly, Morgain married Uriens with her own consent. You do not think Arthur would marry away his dear sister without asking her? Morgawes almost snorted. Morgain is full enough of life that I do not think she would be content in an old man's bed, she said. And if I had a stepson as handsome as yonder Accolon, I know well I would not.
Come, ask the Lady of Cornwall to sit with us, Guinevere said, to put an end to Morgawes's gossip.
And Morgain, too, if you will.
Morgain was safely married to Uriens. What was it to Guinevere if she made a fool of herself, or put her immortal soul at hazard by playing the harlot with this man or that? Uriens, with Morgain and his two younger sons, had come to greet Arthur, who took the old king by both hands, calling him brother-in-law, and kissed Morgain on either cheek.
But you have come to offer me a gift, Uriens. I need no gifts from kinsmen. Your affection is enough, he said. Not only to offer you a gift, but to ask a boon of you, said Uriens. I beg you to make my son Uwain a knight of your round table, and receive him as one of your companions.
Arthur smiled at the slender, dark young man who knelt before him.
How old are you, young Uwain?
15, my lord and king.
Well then, rise, Sir Uwain, said Arthur graciously. You may watch this knight by your arms, and tomorrow one of my companions shall make you knight. By your leave, said Gawain, may I be the one to confer this honour on my cousin Uwain, Lord Arthur? Who better than you, my cousin and friend, Arthur said. If that is agreeable to you, Uwain, let it be so. I receive you willingly as my companion for your own sake,
and because you are stepson to my dear sister. Make him a place at table there, you men. And you, Uwain, may fight in my company tomorrow in the mock battles.
Uwain stammered. I thank you, my king. Arthur smiled at Morgaine.
I thank you for this gift, my sister.
It is a gift to me as well, Arthur, Morgaine said. Uwain has been like a true son to me.
Guinevere thought cruelly that Morgaine looked her age. Her face was touched with subtle lines, and there were streaks of white in the raven hair, though her dark eyes were as fine as ever. And she had spoken of Uwain as her son, and she looked at him with pride and affection. Yet her own son must be older yet.
And so Morgaine, damn her, has two sons, and I not so much as a fosterling.
Morgaine, seated at Urien's side down the table, was conscious of Guinevere's eyes on her. How she hates me, even now when I can do her no harm. Yet she didn't hate Guinevere. She had even ceased to resent the marriage to Urien's, knowing that in some obscure way it had brought her back to what she had once been, priestess of Avalon. Still, but for Guinevere, I would have been married to Accolon at this moment, and as it is, we are at the mercy of some servant who might spy on us, or blab to Urien's for a reward. Here in Camelot they must be very discreet. Guinevere would stop at nothing to make trouble. She shouldn't have come. Yet Uwain had wished for her to see him knighted, and she was the only mother Uwain had ever known.
Urien's could not, after all, live forever.
Though sometimes, in the dragging years, she felt that he had decided to rival old King Methuselah, and she doubted that even the stupid pig farmers of North Wales would accept Avaloch as king. If she could only bear Accolon a child, then no one would question that Accolon, at her side, would reign rightly. She would have risked it. Vivian, after all, had been nearly as old as she was now when Lancelot was born, and she had lived to see him grown. But the goddess had not sent her even the hope of conception, and to be honest, she didn't want it. Uwain was son enough for her, and Accolon had not reproached her for childlessness. No doubt he felt that no one would seriously believe it was Urien's son, though Morgaine doubted not she could persuade her old husband to acknowledge the child his own. He doted on her in everything, and she shared his bed often enough, too often for her taste. She said to Urien's now,
"Let me fill your plate. That roast pig is too rich for you. It will make you ill. Some of those wheaten cakes, perhaps, sopped in the gravy. And here is a fine fat saddle of rabbit."
She beckoned to a serving man carrying a tray of early fruits, and chose some gooseberries and cherries for her husband.
"Here,
I know you are fond of these." "You are good to me, Morgaine," he said,
and she patted his arm.
"It was worth it."
All the time she spent in cosseting him,
caring for his health,
embroidering him fine cloaks and shirts, and even now and then, discreetly, finding a young woman for his bed, and giving him a dose of one of her herb medicines, which would allow him something like normal virility. Urien's was convinced that she adored him, and never questioned her devotion or denied her anything she asked.
The feasting was breaking up now. People moving about the hall, nibbling at cakes and sweets, calling for wine and ale, stopping to speak to kinsmen and friends, whom they saw only once or twice a year.
Urien's was still munching his gooseberries. Morgaine asked leave to go and speak to her kinswoman.
"As you like, my dearest," he mumbled. "You should have cut my hair, my wife. All the companions are wearing their hair shorn."
She patted his scanty locks and said, "Oh, no, my dear, I think it is better suited to your years. You do not want to look like a schoolboy or a monk." And she thought, There's so little of your hair that if you cut it short, your bald spot would shine through like a beacon. Look, the noble Lancelot still wears his hair long and flowing, and Gawain, and Gareth. No one could call them old men.
You are right, as always, Urien said smugly. I suppose it is fitted to a mature man. It's all very well for a boy like Uwain to clip his hair short.
And Uwain, indeed, had shorn his hair close to the nape of his neck in the new fashion.
I mark there is grey in Lancelot's hair as well. We are none of us young any more, my dear.
You were a grandsire when Lancelot was born, Morgaine thought crossly. But she only murmured that none of them was as young as they had been 10 years ago, a truth with which no one could possibly argue, and moved away. Lancelot was still, she thought, the finest-looking man she had ever seen. Next to him even Accolon seemed too perfect, his features too precise. There was grey in his hair, yes, and in the smoothly trimmed beard, but his eyes twinkled with the old smile.
Good day to you, my cousin.
She was surprised at his cordial tone. Yet, she thought, it is true what Urien said. We are none of us so young any more, and there are not many of us who remember that time when we were all young together. He embraced her, and she felt his curly beard silky against her cheek. She asked him, Is Elaine not here?
No. She bore me another daughter but 3 days since. She had hoped the child would be already born, and she well enough to ride to Pentecost. But it was a fine big girl, and she took her own time in coming. We had hoped to have her 3 weeks ago.
How many children have you now, Lance?
3. Galahad is a big lad of 7, and Nimue is 5 years old. I don't see them very often. But their nurses say they are clever and quick for their age. And Elaine would name the new little one Guinevere for the Queen. I think I shall ride north and visit her, Morgaine said. She will be glad to see you, I'm sure. It's lonely there, said Lancelot.
Morgaine didn't think Elaine would be glad to see her at all, but that was between her and Elaine. Lancelot glanced towards the dais where Guinevere had taken Isotta of Cornwall to sit at her side, while Arthur spoke with Duke Marcus and his nephew.
Know you yonder Drustan? He is a fine harper, though not like to Kevin, of course.
Morgaine shook her head. Is Kevin to play at this feast?
I haven't seen him, Lancelot said. The Queen likes him not. The court is grown too Christian for that. Though Arthur values him as a counsellor and for his music as well.
She asked him bluntly, Are you grown a Christian too?
I could wish I were, he said, sighing from the bottom of his heart. That faith seems too simple to me. The idea that we have only to believe that Christ died for our sins once and for all. But I know too much of the truth, of the way life works, with life after life in which we ourselves, and only we, can work out the causes we have set in motion, and make amends for the harm we have done. It stands not in the realm of reason that one man, however holy and blessed, could atone for all the sins of all men done in all lifetimes. What else could explain why some men have all things and others so little? No, that is a cruel trick of the priests, I think. To coax men into thinking that they have the ear of God and can forgive sins in his name. Ah, I wish it were true indeed. And some of their priests are fine and sincere men.
I never met with one who was half so learned or so good as Taliesin, said Morgaine.
Taliesin was a great soul, Lancelot said. Perhaps one lifetime of service to the gods cannot create so much wisdom. And he is one of the great ones who has served them for hundreds of years. Next to him, Kevin seems no more fit to be the Lord Merlin than my little son to sit on Arthur's throne and lead his troops into battle. And Taliesin was big enough to make no quarrel with the priests, knowing they served their god as best they could, and perhaps, after many lives,
they would learn that their god was bigger than they thought him. And I know he respected their strength to live chastely.
That seems to me blasphemy and a denial of life, said Morgaine. And I know Vivian would have thought it so.
Why, she wondered, do I stand here arguing religion with Lancelot of all men?
Vivian, like Taliesin, came from another world and another time, said Lancelot. They were giants in those days, and now we must make do with such as we have.
You are so like her, Morgaine.
He smiled, a rueful half-smile, and it wrenched her heart. She remembered that he had said something like this to her. Nay, she had dreamed it too, but she couldn't remember all. But he went on,
I see you here with your husband and your fine stepson. A credit he will be to the companions. I always wished you happiness, Morgaine, and for so many years you seemed so unhappy. But now you are queen in your own country, and you have a good son.
Surely, she thought, what more could any woman want?
But now I must go and pay my respects to the queen.
Yes, she said, and couldn't keep the bitterness from her voice. You would be eager to do that.
Oh, Morgaine, he said, dismayed.
We have known each other so long. We are all kin.
Cannot we let the past die?
Do you despise me so much? Do you still hate her as much as that?
Morgaine shook her head.
I don't hate either of you, she said. Why should I?
But I thought, now you were wedded, and Guinevere, too, deserves to be left in peace.
You have never understood her, said Lancelot hotly. I well believe you have disliked her since you were both young girls. It is not well done of you, Morgaine. She has repented her sin, and I am wedded, as you say, to another. But I will not shun her as if she were a leper.
If she wants my friendship as her husband's kinsman, it is hers.
Morgaine knew he spoke sincerely.
Well, it was nothing to her. She had now from Accolon what she had so long desired from him.
And strangely, even that was painful, like the space left by an aching tooth after it was drawn. She had loved him so many years that now, when she could look on him without desire, she felt hollow inside. She said softly,
I'm sorry, Lance. I had no wish to make you angry.
As you say, it is all past.
I dare say he really believes that he and Guinevere can be no more than friends. Maybe for him it is so.
And Guinevere has grown so pious, I doubt it not at all.
So there you are, Lancelot. As always, chattering with the court's most beautiful ladies, said a merry voice.
And Lancelot turned and caught the newcomer in a bear hug.
Gareth, how goes it with you in the North Country? And so you too are a married man and a householder. Is it two children your lady has given you now, or three? Handsome, you are better looking than ever. Even Kai couldn't mock you now. I would like it well to have him back in my kitchen, laughed Kai, coming up to clap Gareth on the shoulder. Four sons, is it not? But the Lady Lyonors has twins, like one of the wildcats of your country, does she not? Morgaine, I think you grow ever younger with the years, he added, bending over her hand. He had always liked her.
But when I see Gareth grown and such a man, I feel older than the hills themselves.
Morgaine, too, laughed.
A woman knows she is getting old when she looks at every tall young man and says to herself, I knew him before he was breeched.
And, alas, 'tis true of me, cousin, Gareth bent to hug Morgaine. I remember you used to carve me wooden knights when I was no more than a babe.
You still remember those wooden knights?
Morgaine was pleased. I do.
"'One of them, Lyonors, keeps with my treasure still,'
Garth said.
"'It is bravely painted in blue and red, and my oldest son would gladly have it. "'But I treasure it too greatly. "'Do you know I called it Lancelot when I was a babe, cousin?'
"'The older man laughed, too, and Morgaine thought she had never seen Lancelot "'so carefree and merry as he was now among his friends.
"'Your son is almost as old as my Galahad, I think.' Galahad is a fine boy, though he looks not much like my side of the family. I saw him but a few days ago, for the first time since he was out of breech clouts. And the girls are pretty. Well, they seem so to me.
Gareth turned back to Morgaine and said,
"How does my foster brother Gwydion, Lady Morgaine?"
She said shortly, "I have heard he is in Avalon. I haven't seen him." And turned away. "'Leaving Lancelot to his friends. "'But Gawain joined them, "'bending to give Morgaine an almost filial embrace. "'Gawain was a huge man now, monstrously heavy, "'with shoulders that looked, and probably were, "'strong enough to throw down a bull. "'His face was hacked and bitten with many scars. "'He said,
"'Your son Uwain seems a fine lad. "'I think he will make a good knight.' "'And we may need such. "'Have you seen your brother Lionel, Lance?'
"'No. "'Is Lionel here?' asked Lancelot, glancing around, "'and his eyes fell on a tall, sturdy man "'wearing a cloak of a strange fashion. "'Lionel, brother,
how goes it with you "'in your foggy kingdom beyond the seas?'
"'Lionel came and greeted them, "'speaking with so thick an accent "'that Morgaine found it hard to follow his speech.'
"'All the worse for you not being there, Lancelot. "'We may have some trouble there. "'You have heard? "'You have heard Bors' news?'
"'Lancelot shook his head.
"'I heard nothing later than he was to marry King Hol's daughter,' he said. "'I forget her name. "'Isotta. "'The same name as the Queen of Cornwall,' said Lionel. "'But there has been no marriage as yet.' Hoel, you must know, is one who can never say yea or nay to anything, but must ponder forever the advantage of alliance with Less Britain or Cornwall. Marcus cannot give Cornwall to any, said Gawain dryly. Cornwall is yours, is it not, Lady Morgaine? I seem to remember Uther gave it to the Lady Igraine when he came to the throne, so that you have it of both Igraine and Gaulois. "'Though Gaulois's lands were forfeit to Uther, if I mind the tale aright. "'It all befell before I was born, though you were a child then.'
"'Duke Marcus keeps the land for me,' said Morgaine. "'I knew never that he claimed it. "'Though I know once there was talk I should marry Duke Marcus, or Drustan, his nephew.'
"'It would have been well if you had,' said Lionel, "'for Marcus is a greedy man.' He got much treasure with his Irish lady, and I doubt it not he will try to swallow up all of Cornwall, and Tintagel too, if he thinks he can get away with it, as a fox gets away with a barnyard fowl.
Lancelot said,
I liked better the days when we were all but Arthur's companions. Now I am reigning in Pelennor's country, and Morgaine queen in North Wales, and you, Gawain, should be king in Lothian, if you had your rights.
Gawain grinned at him.
"'I have neither talent nor taste for kingship, cousin. "'I'm a warrior. "'And to dwell always in one place and live at court would weary me to death. "'I'm happy enough that Agravain shall rule at my mother's side. "'I think the tribes have the right of it, "'women to stay home and rule and men to wander about and make war. "'I won't be parted from Arthur. "'But I admit I grow weary of life in court. "'Still.' A mock battle is better than none.
I'm sure you will win honour and credit, said Morgaine, smiling at her cousin. How does your mother, Gawain? I haven't yet spoken with her. She added, with a touch of malice, I have heard she has other help than Agravain in ruling your kingdom. Gawain chuckled broadly.
Aye, 'tis all the fashion now. It's your doing, Lancelot. After you married Pelennor's daughter, I suppose Lamorack thought no knight could be great and courtly and win great renown unless he had first been the para...
He stopped himself at Lancelot's grim face and amended hastily,
"The chosen champion of a great and beautiful queen."
"I think it isn't just a pose. I think Lamorack truly loves my mother, and I begrudge it not. She was wedded to old King Lot when she